Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Funerals have begun for the 50 people killed last week in the attack on a pair of mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. Six victims were laid to rest today. And we're learning more about how the alleged gunman sought to spread a hateful message. In the days before the shooting, he posted links to a racist manifesto across social media in more than 60 places, according to the Washington Post. He also live-streamed the attack on Facebook, and the video continued to appear elsewhere on social media in the ensuing hours. Facebook reports that the live footage was viewed fewer than 200 times, but the company also says it went on to remove roughly 1.5 million uploaded copies of the video in the next 24 hours. Meanwhile, over at YouTube, Google engineers worked through the night to identify and take down hundreds of thousands of reposts of the video. So what responsibility should companies like Facebook, Google-owned YouTube, Reddit, and Twitter have for this kind of content? And what role do these platforms play in radicalizing people like the shooter in the first place? Let's turn to Joan Donovan. She directs the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. Joan, welcome
Thanks
to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, let me just start with the first part of this. You know, the responsibility of these companies after an attack like this one that we just saw in New Zealand. I mean, does it highlight a profound flaw in the design of social media just at the outset? I mean, they're designed by definition to disseminate information, video content quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that when we were first developing web standards, regulations, and protocols, we weren't really thinking about vulnerabilities. We weren't thinking about the way that these systems would be leveraged to do harm. And that's what we're reckoning with now. We have, you know, really 10 years of social media behind us and a lot of practice. And now, more than ever, we're a tightly connected world. And the way in which these platform companies respond to incidences like these, it needs to change. And we know now that, especially with this attack, that the perpetrator sought out even mainstream and relatively obscure platforms to ensure that this message would stay online.
You know, one of the things that stands out to me in Facebook's statement is that figure I read earlier about fewer than 200 people seeing online. But still, out of that, Facebook says that none of those users reported the video during the live broadcast. And I know that Facebook relies in part on its community of users to police one another, to report inappropriate content. And I just wonder if that's a broken system, Joan, because the lack of reporting in this case makes me wonder if the people who know how to find the darkest content online are not the ones who are going to help take it down.
Yeah, this is something that I studied when I was at Data and Society. We issued a report with Becca Lewis, was the lead author on this report on the Alternative Influence Network. And we were looking at how certain extremist ideas can live on particular platforms, and then how it gets disseminated has a lot to do with the structure of amplification and the way in which different users will copy and paste and amplify this across different platforms. And the idea that 1.5 million attempts at upload speaks to me that there's all different interests at play here. It's not just extremists that were trying to do this. There are probably news organizations, probably people who are part of the alternative tech free speech movement were probably trying to upload this, as well as marketers, you know, and you know, junk news organizations that knew they could get clicks.
And I say that Facebook claims that 1.2 million out of the 1.5 million were detected right away by their AI algorithms. But that's still a bunch. That's still a few hundred thousand slipping through the cracks and needing to be taken down by people. So there's still some work to do there. And I just wonder if you've come up with another strategy for how companies can prevent this from happening, because it's not the first time, right? I mean, I'm thinking about in 2015, the shooting of two TV journalists in Virginia. 2017, there was a Facebook live stream of a gunman talking about a killing in Cleveland. I mean, so this is not a totally one-off thing.
Yeah, we know that from researchers that have studied live streaming these communities that we do see incidences of crime as well as suicides and other horrible incidences of harassment that are being live streamed. And so we know the problem, and these platforms know the problem. The real issue at stake is that there's no sanctions, there's no rules, there's no playbook. And so until we get some kind of playbook in place that says, yes, you must monitor live streams or you must take down content immediately that is violent. You know, Facebook still had to make a choice to take down this content. There's no rule that says they have to. There's no sanction if they don't. And so this is really public pressure that's getting to them, which makes me wonder, where are our legislators? Where is the legislation we need around broadcast that will help us determine what is the right use case here? And the other thing that I often suggest to these companies is that as people learn how to use and exploit, in a lot of ways, social media in order to gain attention, we have to think differently, not just about the technology, but who uses the technology and why.
We're talking with Joan Donovan, who directs the Technology and Social Change Research Project at the Shorenstein Center. And Joan, I'm just wondering, I mean, what would that legislation look like? Because I can see the pushback argument being, look, this is just sort of the plumbing. You know, if somebody makes a threatening phone call, you know, we don't come after Verizon or AT&T, whoever the phone company is, right? So, I mean, wouldn't the platforms here, the social media companies, make the same argument? Well, you can't penalize us.
There are rules against making 100,000 threatening phone calls, right? And so this is part of the broadcast matrix, is we have to actually understand that as things scale, as they reach new audiences, as they break out of communities of users that are watching them and know what they're watching, we have to have different rules in place for when things are touching many, many more people. And that's really a failure of the way in which we scaled the web without scaling it to use the rules that we've already put in place.
So we've talked mostly about the spread of the footage sort of after the fact or even live in the moment. But what about before, Joan? What have you been able to find out about the playbook, if there is one? Is there kind of a script for how white supremacists or other hateful groups spread their message online and recruit other people to their ideology?
Yeah, there's a lot of researchers in this space, and we often share ideas, and we often share new places that we find where people are issuing calls for violent altercation. Some of these take the form of very grand conspiracies, and so we track conspiracy theories as well as try to understand when people are getting organized for on-the-ground actions. And in the States, we can say definitively that last year and the year before, we saw a lot more white supremacist groups showing up in public places. And they were showing up in public places because they had been meeting each other online and coordinating. And so that is an empirical fact. It's very easy to trace. The issue is the degree to which they're using sometimes semi-private messaging or private messaging, or they're just using the open web but using anonymous accounts. And so the issue here has to do with the fact that there are many places in which these groups congregate, but there's only a few places where they're really able to recruit new people or they're really able to spread their messages to a broader public. And that's where the major platforms come into play.
So if they're using those platforms, you know, the people who oppose their ideology use them too, though, right? I mean, we've seen the counter-protesters have used, you know, Facebook or Twitter or other social media tools to organize. We've seen student organizers after the Parkland shooting last year, make the March for Our Lives, really a substantial political movement in this country with the aid of social media as well. So how do we weigh the benefits and the awful side of social media?
Yeah, this is also one of the fundamental flaws about the way that social media and content moderation has been designed. It's designed to look for behaviors, so all coordination might even look the same. So the coordination of the students in Parkland might look very similar to the coordination of a white supremacist rally.
To the algorithm, to the computer.
To the algorithm, to the computer. This is why we need to have some kinds of controls around content, especially when it comes to hate speech, harassment, and incitement to violence.
So what can users do differently? I mean, as I mentioned earlier, there is at least part of what's built into using these platforms is the expectation that as a user community, you will help to police yourself. Mm-hmm. How can people do that better, assuming they want to?
Yeah, I think it's a big assumption that people want to work for platform companies in this position. I think people expect that they get content and it's free of spam and it's free of libelous material and that it's free of hate speech, that it's free of pornography. We do have expectations as consumers on these platforms. And so I think it's really not the user's fault that this stuff is spreading, but there is a weakness in the design of these systems that is allowing groups that want this content to get online to remain online.
That's Joan Donovan. She's the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center. Joan, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.